Welcome to Linux Slugcast, episode 29. We are an open podcast / lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. If you would like to join us, please visit linuxslugcast.com for the server details. We also have a Mumble how-to on the site explaining how to configure Mumble. Then just join us in the Linux Lugcast room. During the live show, if you are unable to join us in Mumble, you can also listen to us streaming live. You can join us in the IRC on Freenode in the hash Linux Lugcast channel. If you have any questions, comments, or topics that you would like us to discuss, please email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. We also have a Google Plus community site. Please visit our website for the direct link. I'm your host for this evening, 5150 on the channel. We also have Father Finch.
Hello.
Oh, okay, I pushed the wrong place. And we have Fweeb.
Do-do-do-do.
Honky Magoo.
Evening.
Kevin Wisher.
Howdy.
Netminer.
Hello, folks.
And welcome to the cast, Netminer. And we have Taj.
What's good, everybody?
Okay, I don't think we have any business to carry over from the last episode. I have very little to contribute this month. And I think I told you last time that I thought I was done talking about how to get your TV shows over the internet, at least legitimately. And I was bemoaning the fact that HBO, which I'm able to get now over my Android device because I'm HBO subscriber over cable, that they're coming out with their internet-only service. And unfortunately, in the beginning, it's only going to be available on Apple devices, your iPads, your iPhones, and your actual Apple desktops. However, I found out in the last couple of weeks, it turns out you can get HBO at $15 a month on Android if you add it to the $20 a month Sling TV package. And you can find out about that at www.sling.com. Now, I've looked at Sling before and wasn't very excited. I think there's CNN for a channel. They tout sports. I don't really bother to watch that much sports. They're extra premium channels. I think Encore, but they don't have the Encore Western channel. I mean, Encore is like HBO if you wanted movies that were than what comes on Netflix. So I shouldn't say that. It may be about the same as Netflix as far as the caliber and age of movies that they get. But I looked yesterday. I didn't see anything on Sling that by itself I would want to pay $20 a month for. So it comes down to whether I want to pay $35 so I can continue watching Game of Thrones. And let's face it, there are other ways to get that content, which we shall not discuss. But you know, 35 is just too much, guys. You got to do a better deal than that for me. Okay. On other topics. Well, let's see. You guys have any thoughts on that? Well, seeing none, Kevin Wisher was going to talk about setting up software RAID with MDADM, and I think he was also going to talk about replacing a failed drive in a RAID array.
There was some feedback, though.
Oh, was there?
Yeah, Frank Bell replied to the thing about Slackware.
Okay, yeah, I see that. I thought we did that 2 weeks ago. It'd be helpful if we had that. Let me see if I can pull that up now.
I've got French. Do you want to, Father French? You want to take that since that was your topic?
Yes, absolutely. So Frank Bell wrote to us, and he kind of chastised me, and rightly so, about my summary of my use of Slacks or Slackware, and that I mistakenly said that Slackware does not install with X window environment, and that is, it couldn't be further from the truth. And his main concern was that I was perpetuating a myth that Slackware was difficult to use, and it's not. By no means is it not. So he and I had a conversation, a couple of emails back and forth about it, and I appreciate that he called me out on that because I didn't realize how I might have misinformed people. When you do the initial installation, especially when you do the full installer, the installer method that I chose brought you through an NCURSIS like menu in which you get to pick your desktop environment. Now, primarily Slack, the basic Slackware comes, or not the, the full installation comes with all of the KDE suite of tools, but you can select a number of window managers and desktop environments to go along with that, from something as simple as, you know, Tom's Window Manager or Blackbox to Window Maker and Fluxbox, but you could do a full KDE, you could do XFCE, whatever, you know, there's a number of them that you can install from the get-go. So when I said that Slackware was forcing me to learn how to install an X windowing system, I was mistaken in saying that. They do have that option. You just have to change your run level from 3 to 4 when you do it so that it automatically boots into a window environment. So I was mistaken in saying that. And the conversation naturally grew on to, I was doing some work earlier this week in which I needed a couple of packages. I had a customer who was installing an IP telephony system, and the problem was that we were putting in a new pair of switches at the site, but the business itself had 3 separate entities that had their own networks, and those own network, each network had its own firewall and its own, you know, set of rules and whatnot, and I had to combine all of them into this set of switches and make sure that the DHCP redirection was happening correctly for the phones to find the call manager. And I have, in addition to the Slackware machine that I was using for testing, I had another low-end laptop that I had thrown on Slackware on during the last show, and I started looking up in, you know, Slack builds for DNS mask, which you could refer back to an earlier show, which I talked about a little bit about that, how you could use DNS mask for DNS redirection or mapping, and I was going to use that as just a basic DHCP server so that I could VLAN tag a single interface into these switches and pretend that I was each one of these networks so that there wouldn't be any overlap. And I checked Slack builds to find the DNS mask package, and it wasn't there. And I, you know, kind of typed it up, and then I realized, oh, wait a second. I looked, and sure enough, the config file was right where it belonged. Slackware had already included that as one of the packages. I think the other one that I was trying to use was Nmap. So Slackware is a great distribution. It has far more than you realize when you start it, and it's well worth anybody, you know, boot it up in a VM, try it on hardware if you have it, give it a shot. It's a different experience, but it's a full-fledged experience.
And how is there anything new you'd like to report on your new Slackware install?
At this time, no. I have had little time. I've been really busy the past couple of weeks. I'm actually using it right now. I'm still in the terminal where I've got to connect it to a server, and this seems ridiculous, but I've got an SSH session on one machine that's sitting at a desk, and I've got another one where I can actually stand up and type, and I'm using Screen with the same login credentials, so it's the same screen session so that I can chat in IRC, whether I'm sitting or I'm standing.
Have you done any updates since installation, Father Finch?
I have not.
Okay, Kevin Wisher, why don't you tell us about MDADM?
Okay, first, how many here has some experience or any experience with Linux software RAID?
I do.
I set it up a few years ago because I had what I knew was a system was probably not fast enough for what I was wanting to do with it. I wanted to build a MIFTV front end, or rather back end, and it was a Pentium 4 system with spinning hard drives, and I figured setting them up in RAID 1 might make them fast enough so that they wouldn't hiccup on recording content. I set up the RAID successfully, but I never really got much beyond it on that project.
Well, this particular install or build, RAID build that I've got running now is probably my third or fourth setup that I've done. It's not that difficult to do. It's a great way for you to repurpose an old machine to make a NAS. Network attached storage server, a file server out of. You can go back to some of our previous episodes and look for the Samba tutorial I did, and you could implement this a software RAID as a file server storage to serve your, you know, whatever media center. You can serve files off of it. Mine is being used for is being used to record MIFTV recordings. It's a three disk RAID 5 setup. Each disk is 2 terabyte. In the show notes, I've included a link to a nice little RAID calculator, so you can kind of, you know, figure out how much storage, the number of spare disks you have, and what kind of storage you're going to get out of the different variations of RAID. I choose RAID 5 because I just happen to have 3 2-terabyte drives laying around that they were used drives that I've scavenged out of people's computers that didn't want them anymore. And you can use various sizes of drives in your array, but it's going, or you can actually partition a drive and use a partition. You don't have to use the whole drive. So you've got it's quite flexible on how you configure it, but the total RAID storage will default to the smallest partition or smallest drive that you have in your array. So if you happen to have a 500 gigabyte, a 1 terabyte drive, and two 1 terabyte drives, and you want to use all three in the same RAID 5 array, the 500 gigabyte drive is going to be the determining factor for the total size. It will only, so you can put that into the calculator. You're not going to be utilizing the 2 1-terabyte drives, but later on, if you happen to come across another 1-terabyte drive so that you can match all the drives, you can, by software commands with MDADM as the tool Linux utility that you use to configure and run software RAID, you can remove that smaller drive and then replace it with a larger drive and then resize your RAID so that you gain all that that extra space that you've, that the system can actually see now. So the first step you want to do is actually install the package MDADM, and it's available in your favorite whatever distro package manager you have. It's either apt-get or yum or whatever package, Pac-Man, whatever package manager distro you're running, it's readily available. The first link in the show notes, it will tell you everything you want to know about MDADM that you want to know, and then some. First thing you want to do, of course, after installing the MDADM package, is you want to use FDisk or your favorite disk partitioning tool to prepare the disk. Now, in my case, the 3 2-terabyte drives, I just ran FDisk, /dev/sdb, and immediately just wiped all of, erased the whole drive and created one whole new partition for utilizing the full size of the disk. And then there's one of the options in FDisk is to label the file system type, and the option I've always chosen is Linux RAID, and that's one of the options in FDisk. I think it's the option T from the FDisk command once you're inside the FDisk. So you just label that, and I don't know if that's fully necessary, but I that one tutorial I followed, that's what they recommended, so that's what I've always done in the past. And then you make sure and write that once you've partitioned that disk and got the right Linux file system type labeled on there. Do that for all 3 disks, and then you're ready to run the MDADM command to what's called create and assemble the RAID. And I'm not going to go into the exact specifics of all the commands. It's in the links I'm providing. It's not that difficult to do. You just follow the steps. So first you need to decide how many disks you're going to use and what RAID configuration. The minimum I recommend for file server would be the RAID 1, to where you can use 2 disks that are mirrored, so that you could actually still lose one disk. You could have one failed disk and it would still retain your data. That would be the bare minimum. I like the RAID 5. You get a parity drive, but you can still only lose one drive, which I'll talk about here in a little while because I had it happen to me. So the command, you just build the command is MDADM --create space, and then every RAID device block name is it'd be /dev/MD0 would be like, which the zero could be any number. Zero is usually the default for the first RAID device you have. But then you're going to add in all your drives or partitions. However, you just have to keep note of what partitions and drive letters, what SDA device you're using. So you'd create, and then you just add each drive partition, so /dev/sda1 or b1, c1, d1, however your drives are configured. And when you add those to the array and create the array, it'll take quite a while to do RAID 5 with 3 terabyte drives. It may take like 3 hours for that to assemble and build, and you can monitor that progress, and you can even start writing files to it while it's doing this. It's kind of neat that you can actually start using it while it's building the array. Any questions so far?
What file system do you like to use on your RAIDs?
After the RAID, before you start building the array, you have to format the array. No, you let it build first, and then you format it with a file. You just format it with the same, you know, command line mkfs.ext4. I format mine with the ext4, and that seems to work fine for, you know, using as a file server. You can choose. There's some topics on down that kind of explains the different file systems and some other things you can do to tweak the chunk sizes, and it gives you some suggestions for ext 2, 3, and 4 file systems on how to, you know, optimize for those file systems. It gives you a calculation. You plug in some numbers, and then you plug in those calculations into the command to format it correctly so that it's more optimized and faster, I believe. I didn't go that far with mine. I'm not too worried about performance. I haven't had any issues with performance, with just being a file server and even being a storage for my Myth TV recordings. I don't notice any issues with my recordings, so I didn't really dig in too deep with all the tweaking that you can do with it. But then once the RAID is all formatted, it's treated, all three drives is treated just like a block device. It's like a one hard drive. It's a /dev MD0, like I stated earlier. So in your fstab file, you just created a new line to mount it at boot, and it mounts it just like a single hard drive. And as far as as far as looking at it, it appears as one hard drive. It tells you, you know, how much total storage it has with all three disks together. With my configuration with the three 2 terabyte drives, I get roughly 4 terabytes of storage, because it's using the third disk for parity. And I can't really describe, if anybody can define parity a little bit better, they're more than welcome to go for it.
The short version is that for every couple of bits on the two drives that you're spanning data across, there's a bit on your third drive that's used to validate the proper contents of it. That's sort of the quick and dirty explanation.
Yes, I like quick and dirty. And you can also, if you look at the RAID calculator, I provide a link to, you can also do more than three disks in a RAID 5, and you can set up the fourth disk as a hot spare, so that, and I can't remember if this will automatically swap in the spare drive when one fails, or whether it's just you have to run a command to do a hot swap. But right after our last episode, I did have a drive fail in my RAID array. I could have left it like that for weeks on end, and as long as I didn't lose another drive, I was fine. But of course, and you're maybe asking, well, how did I know that drive failed? Well, if you go back and look through our past episodes, we had a topic on setting up email notifications for you. And there's a line that you can add into your MDADM config file to send you notifications of RAID events in your array. And that's how I found out I had a failed drive. I got an email notification, told me exactly what drive failed. And now I'll talk about how you go about replacing a failed drive in the software RAID. There's another link goes through it. And then, of course, at any time, if you go to the terminal or SSH into your machine that has the RAID, you can always run cat /proc/mdstat to see the status of your array. And basically, the email notification is system is using that command to monitor your array for you. So when it sees something gone awry in your RAID array, it sends you the email notification. Then of course you use the MDA MD-ADM commands to actually remove the failed drive. You shut down your power down the system, swap in. I always power it down. I don't know if you can do this live or not with SATA drives or not. Then you slap in the new drive, and then you're going to kind of go through the same process you did when you created the array. You're going to have to prepare the drive with FDisk or whatever partitioning tool you use, and then you just add that disk back in with the MDADM command. You can add that back in, and it will automatically start rebuilding the array and transferring the appropriate data over to it from the parity drive. Is that correct?
Well, I've heard madam, but which one did you lose? Did you lose your parity? I assume you lost one of your data drives, since you say it's copying from the parity drive, but should still be able to recreate the parity drive if that's the one that you lose.
Well, I don't know which one is the parity drive. It doesn't really tell you in any of the commands I've seen exactly which one is the parity drive or what, you know,
now,
which one.
I guess you'd have to remember how you labeled your drives, because either your email notification or some diagnostics you run, you've got to know which one the dead drive is.
I said it tells you which drive. You can tell by which drive has failed. The cat proc md stat command will show you which drive is dead. Now, the problem is I found, and I wish I would have taken more care when I plugged I tried to plug the drives into the motherboard in the correct labeling that was on the motherboard, because you'll have the SATA ports labeled on the motherboard, like zero, like the particular motherboard I have has 6 SATA ports. So zero, I think, has the CD-ROM and DB CD-ROM, the optical drive. Then one has my smaller drive that has the OS installed on it. And then I followed suit with, 2, 3, and 4 for the arrays, and I labeled the cables 1, 2, and 3, thinking that the first drive, the drive plugged into port 2 would be SDB, and it doesn't work out that way. So yeah, I had to kind of guess by powering the system down, unplugging a SATA cable, trying to boot it, and running FDisk to see which drives were active and which ones weren't. It floors me. It doesn't follow this numbering of the ports on the motherboard. So I should have taken more care to figure out exactly which drives were, per port on the motherboard were A, B, D, C, whatever.
They used to do that, but when SATA and stuff came along, you can do the eSATA, and the numbering started getting really weird, which is why the recommendation is to use UUIDs for drives now.
Right. Yeah. You can also, you can utilize that too. But once I figured out which drive it was, not because it wasn't reporting the correct drive, it was because I couldn't figure it out by hardware wise because of the cabling and the port numbering. I was trying to be logical about it, and for some reason it didn't follow the logical reasoning that I had in my mind. Once I found the failed drive by, unplugging the cables from the motherboard, booting it up, and finding the drive. Once I got the drive in and then repartitioned it and added it back into the array, it just took off rebuilding on its own. Since I already had data in the array, it took the first time I seen the process, it tells you the number of minutes it's going to be. It was like 360 minutes to rebuild that array. So it sounds complicated, and it is kind of overwhelming the first time you do it. But once you follow this tutorial, it kind of all makes sense to you. And it's really a nice way to use repurpose an old machine as a file server and gain extra storage from, ganging up spare drives you have. There's also other ways to do it. I think you can do a JBOD if your motherboard. I think most motherboards support a or most motherboards nowadays have where you can do a hardware RAID right on the motherboard. I don't know how many ports they support. I've never done it that way. I've just always done the software RAID. To me, it's easier to add, you know, remove and replace a failed drive. I can take that, I could take that whole array and move it to another machine and plug it in, and with just a little bit of you know, looking at the config files and making sure the drives labeling, if I was to use UID labeling, it wouldn't be no problem. But or I don't know if that's per motherboard. Would UIDs transfer across motherboards?
I don't think so. Also, you should be careful on the motherboards that say that they have some form of hardware RAID. Most of the time, if you're talking about a motherboard that's in the like $100 to $200 range, that's not real hardware RAID. It's what they call like a quasi hardware RAID or soft hardware RAID. When that uses, instead of using MDADM, it uses DM. There's a lot of D's and M's in there, but that's not being used much anymore. So you're really better off using software RAID unless you have a real like RAID controller that's not built into the motherboard.
I agree. I got burnt once by a motherboard setting up a, of course, this was spec Windows 95, Windows 2000 era, doing a RAID 0 stripe setup to gain some speed, and got burnt by that pretty hard. So since then, I've never used any onboard RAID functions.
Yeah, if you haven't mentioned it yet, I've been out for a couple minutes. Kay Wisher, would you care to address, I guess the situation has changed, but we always used to deride Windows with an add-in RAID card as fake RAID.
What type of add-in card?
Well, if you had a RAID card, I mean, if you did Windows, to get RAID on Windows, you either have to have RAID built into the motherboard, and sometimes I guess that still could be fake RAID, or you had to buy like a PCI card originally, and you know, now we have faster slots, PCIX or whatever. Add-in card that you would plug your IDE or your SATA drives or whatever you have into to do RAID. And it's,
I think you got that backwards. If it's, in my understanding, fake RAID is anything that it is anything not using a true RAID controller. I may be wrong, but that's the way I've always understood it. Even this software RAID would be considered fake RAID because it's running in software, not hardware. Where if you had a true RAID controller, it's got its own controller right on the board, and that is true RAID.
Yes, that's right. Typically, if it's on the motherboard, and it's going to be that's a fake RAID, and you're going to be better off using software RAID instead of trying to shoehorn that into trying to behave properly. If you have an actual separate RAID controller card, then that's going to give you real RAID capabilities, and you can actually use that for configuring, you know, whether you're going to do RAID 1.0, 1.5, 10, whatever.
And most true hardware RAID cards will have it when you're booting up, you'll actually see a key combination you press to actually go boot into its BIOS to configure the RAID. So you configure it, you know, directly at the hardware level, right off the controller. And it's, if memory serves me, I've never done a true RAID card on my own. Most of the ones I've done are server, you know, physical servers at work, and usually they, you know, they're already configured when you get them shipped in, or you run a setup disk that the manufacturer sends, and you just tell it what RAID you want the box this will be set up on, that configures it all for you.
Yeah, that's what it was on my HP Rack server. It took me a little bit to figure out. It had like a couple 31 gig drives, SCSI drives, and they were set up as 62 gig of storage. In other words, two individual drives not set up as RAID. So I had to go back through and wipe them and configure them as RAID 1.
Now there, you can, like I always set up a smaller drive as my OS drive. You can actually install your OS to a software RAID. The install directions for doing that are quite convoluted, and I don't think all the built-in installers will actually pick up the, except for maybe like Debian or Ubuntu server, something that's a server specific OS will actually detect, will have MDADM as part of its default packages already on there in the live. But if you're just using a standard desktop distro, you have to kind of jump through some hoops if you want to install your OS to a pre-configured software RAID. Like I think I was saying, once this software RAID is set up, you can actually, if say your OS gets borked, you can reinstall a new OS and basically install MDADM, and if you have a backup of your MDADM config, or you can rebuild the config file via command too, you can be back up and running with a fresh install with no problem. That's kind of that's another thing I like about the software RAID, is if you're not dependent on the hardware of a RAID controller, so, or the build, the motherboard hardware RAID controller, fake RAID controller. So it's all software driven. I guess you do lose some performance by using all software because it's not running, of course, on a controller on the hardware level. But for home use, I have not found any performance issues.
Well, especially if your RAID's on a separate machine that's not doing any processing but serving files, you're not talking too much of a performance hit there.
Right, and it doesn't take much of a CPU to run this either. I mean, for a small file server, I think Phoebe mentioned in IRC earlier that you're running yours off of an Atom-based board. So, I mean, it doesn't take a lot of processing power to run a file server. An Atom processor with 2 gigs of RAM is plenty for, home file server.
So what we're talking about, to make it clear to the audience, even with gigabit Ethernet, the bottleneck of the network itself is going to be great enough to make whether it's RAID or not RAID rather transparent.
I would say your net, even with standard, now it's escaping me. What's the level below gig?
100 base T.
Right. I mean, even when I still had that, it's going to act as one drive. So, I mean, you're not going to see a bottleneck on a home network, I don't think, unless you're really, really hitting it hard. I mean, you'd have to be really doing above average to really care about whether it was hardware or software RAID, I think, in my mind.
As a matter of fact, on my workstation, I use software RAID for RAID 1 across two hard drives because I'm kind of paranoid about my data. And so I run a software RAID across two terabyte drives. So if one drive goes out and I lose my data, I still have another drive that I can salvage it from. And I do a lot of pretty heavy number crunching on my computer, and I don't see a whole lot of performance hit.
So we're talking about using the RAID 1 for redundancy, and I know there's people listening to this shouting into their computers saying that still that's no excuse for not doing external backup.
No, not at all.
Definitely. Yeah, this is phase one. I mean, like I said, I'm paranoid about my data, so step one is version control, step two is having a RAID, and then step three is having offsite backup of said RAID to another RAID.
Yeah, whenever whenever you're talking about a RAID, you have to be considering it in terms of high availability rather than backup.
Yeah, the network attached storage you're using for RAID, ideally, that you're using for backup, not for archival, for backup. Ideally, that should also be a RAID.
Can I break in here for from left field? What about USB based RAIDs?
Never tried it. With today's USB 3 drives and ports, I think it's feasible. I don't even think I have a computer in the house that has USB 3.0.
Well, yeah, please go ahead, Netminer.
I'm looking at a very small application, basically as a learning device on something like a Raspberry Pi, where you can even use all these flash drives you have sitting around.
That would be a perfect test bed to do, depending on which Pi you had. If you got the Model B and have two USB ports and don't have a need for anything else coming out of those ports, you could put two USB sticks in and create a small RAID 1 array and see how it performs.
Yeah, I looked a couple years ago. In fact, I spent a bunch of money on hardware and it all went down in the fire. I never got all put together. But I evaluated, first you do have external RAID boxes that are USB. So you've got a box that you can install two hard drives in RAID and then plug that in through one USB port into the Raspberry Pi. You also could get a Raspberry Pi and plug in two external USB drives and set them up as RAID. But at the time, there was a sale on Newegg on a NAS system from Buffalo that had internal built-in RAID. And I figured, I compared prices, and I think I still came out at $100 or so, but, oh, no, more than that with the drives. Okay, but, by the time I bought two drives and put them in the Buffalo controller, of course, that gives you less control of what software you're actually running. I mean, you know it's Linux at the base, but you don't know what Linux, or you can't really get under the hood. And, setting that as a backup system, because I think the Buffalo box was like $60 on sale. And in my opinion, for the efficiency, that came out superior as to buying let's say your storage is all awash either way. That came out to me to be more efficient than a Raspberry Pi plus a USB box to put the drives in, or even a Raspberry Pi. Then you've got to get the external power and all that set up. It still worked out cheaper to get the Buffalo box. So that may also be an avenue to investigate before you spend a bunch of money on a Raspberry Pi and external power. USB external storage.
Well, I have a lot of, actually, I'm talking about a micro RAD system eating up a very small, just for a personal, as again, an experimental system, a test system that would eat up a lot of the 8 gig and 16 gig flash drives I have sitting around, running off of a hub of some kind, and just using the Pi as a tiny, maybe deep backup, a deep, high reliability by deep RAID 5 with, or better, just running it for a certain critical data set.
And there is, escapes me now, there's that ARM box that actually has an internal SATA connector. Of course, it's not, you'd have to have an external box to power the drive, and it's only one connector, so it's not enough. And then there was, oh, you go way back, all the cloud storage boxes that if you broke them open, they had a SATA connector inside them.
I'm just thinking with the Raspberry Pi and all, and I have a ton of drives around here, I can hack around and try it out. Also with a quad core Pi, I can have that RAID slash server handling a lot of the other, maybe Git and other things on top of it, and just put it somewhere with a hub and all of the drives of a certain size to do my RAID and experiment with it before I go to a purpose-built NAS.
It'd be a fun little experiment. My only concern there would be reliability, because sometimes it depends on what sort of thumb drives and stuff you've got, but some of those can be made with some pretty chintzy materials, and that's sort of the only concern I have there, is that you might see a lot of individual device drivers if you're just sort of cobbling it together from random thumb drives you've got floating around the house.
Well, I do have to say that I, and you guys have heard me say this before, I am impressed. I don't know how it compares to the hard kernel C1, which also has a more powerful video controller, but there is night and day difference between the version 1 Pi and the version 2. And I've had both, and the version 1, of course, this wouldn't work be directly applicable for using it for network storage, but now the version 1, it really didn't even have the power to browse well, you know, not watching movies or whatever. You just couldn't hardly load a web page on it.
Yeah, that's why the server 1...
Straight to YouTube.
That's why the version 1 made a good small server, though.
Well, that's what I intend to use mine for, is plug my two external USB drives into it. Not in read, at least not right now, but you use it just as a portal to that storage on the network.
And I still stand by the fact that it ran Raspbian C relatively well.
Yeah, that's what I put Raspbian on it, and figured, well, if it run Raspbian, I can install XBMC on it and have the same thing, plus have, you know, my regular programs. But turns out, firstly, if you go to looking up how to put XBMC on top of Raspbian, it says there's like 1,000 steps. And I guess the only way that the XBMC was actually working, it wasn't using X, it was writing directly to the video controller.
Yeah, I'm running RaspBMC on one of my, actually both of my Pis, and yeah, it runs it straight to the frame buffer and does 1080p just fine for me.
Also, XBMC, I think, is now Kodi or something. Is that the one?
It is. Though I'm not sure if RaspBMC changed their name yet.
Isn't it OpenElect now?
That was always a separate thing, I thought.
Oh, okay.
See, I thought so too, but I heard a lot of people talking recently, and they're talking like OpenElect is the new Kodi or something. I've been very confused by that as well.
I always thought they were separate projects, but I may be all wet.
See, so did I.
I think they are every time I've looked, but I haven't. Since I set up the install, I've sort of installed it and forgotten it. So let me see if I can look it up.
While you're looking that up, I pasted in the results off of my machine that has the RAID that I was speaking of into the IRC. As you can see, it's on that last line, it's showing 3/3 and then the UUU in brackets there. Well, when the OneDrive failed, it showed 2/2/3 and then UU and an underscore, and it actually told you okay, that where it says MD127:active RAID 5, it actually showed me which SD device was not there. So, and if I would have labeled my cables to my motherboard in correspondence to these Unix device, you know, device block labels, it would have been easier for me to find the failed drive. And I should have done that while I was unplugging it and trying to figure that out. Your hindsight's always 20/20. So that's how, and this is what shows up in my email notification. This exact same results of this command is what shows up in the email notification when a drive fails. So that's how I was alerted to the drive failing. So if you're running a software RAID, go back. I can't remember what episode it was, but look up for email notifications. There's a very simple way to set up email notifications for your home machines to monitor different specific, you know, services.
So I guess you took the normal hacker route then, Kay Wisher, to figure out what you just on drive at a time to see what failed.
Right. I just had to do trial and error. And of course, it was the last drive I unplugged.
Always.
And I figured out OpenELEC and RaspBMC are separate projects. RaspBMC has now, according to their website, evolved to OSMC, which is the Open Source Media Center, and they support a whole bunch of devices, including the Pi 2 and their own sort of baked device that they have there. I can post a link to it in the chat.
That's neat. That's shades of what is the failed device, SBMC, to mark nearly killed.
Any other questions about software RAID? Like I say, if you've got a spare case sitting around with a good working motherboard, P4 or better, or even Fweeb's running his off of an Atom-based board, it doesn't take much to just set it up, and even a Raspberry Pi, like Netminer mentioned, you could actually experiment with it too with some USB sticks, USB drives, some type of external drive enclosure. That's something I've never tried as an external drive enclosure. That would be something I might look into for later, but especially nowadays, it's getting hard. This particular case I have this in has four 3.5-inch drive bays, so it's packed full with hard drives. And I've got a big fan sitting in front of those hard drives, so keeping them cool. So that's important to think about too, is cooling. If you're going with 3.5-inch, you know, standard drives, is cooling, keep it cool. But you can, if you just, you know, if you got stuff, spare parts laying around, it's a nice little project to do and play around with.
Okay. Go ahead, Dan.
One moment, folks. If you want to do anything with a Raspberry Pi, and probably with a lot of USB-based solutions, you have to go to UUIDs. That is to say, individual partition/drive IDs. You can't assume that the SDX mark will stay the same from plugin to plugin or from boot to boot.
Right, and as I was reading about it, the UUID is determined when the disk is formatted, so it should transition between operating systems.
I've been looking at this as a part of the process of booting an operating system, not on the micro SD cards for the Pi. You can actually assign or generate the UUID and assign it to each device as part of the device preparation, or each partition as part of the preparation. So at boot, everything just goes through and looks and, all right, there's that one, there's this one, there's the other one, and your FSTAB works accordingly.
Another thing to consider, if you're dual booting, this is, you know, Windows is not going to see the Madam drive. So if you're married to RAID on a dual boot, you're probably going to have to add in the external hardware controller.
Now, Netminer, have you had any success on booting up a Raspberry Pi on anything besides the SD card?
Quite frankly, I haven't gotten my Pi yet, but there's a lot of stuff on the net about doing it, and even off of a USB stick, it's faster than the SD card, especially if it's like a USB 3 stick. What you have to do is that there's a small FAT32 partition, which is essentially the BIOS slash all the configuration stuff that a normal computer would have on the BIOS scenario, which tells it, you know, how fast to run, tells a lot of stuff about where the boot partition is, where the root partition is, all of the fixed partition on the SD card. The main partition can be moved by designating by moving the data and pointing the config file on the first partition of the SD card at the appropriate real boot partition on the device external.
So you would still need the SD card as kind of like the BIOS for it.
Think of the SD card sort of as your boot ROM slash the CMOS memory of your average PC.
Right, that makes sense.
Probably closer to the situation with UNet booting that you can, you know, if you've got an older computer, I guess I'm going the wrong way. If you've got an older computer that cannot boot to a USB stick, there's a way UNet booting and some of the technologies based on it. You can burn a CD-ROM and it will boot to the CD and then it'll go look for the USB stick. So it'd be something similar to that, I would think.
Actually, I think you're thinking of Plop Linux.
Okay, I think you're right. That's Plop.
Also, while you cannot use the boot partition configured that way, it can be used as a rescue partition, or it can be used as a low access sort of archive storage partition. It still will be EXT4 or whatever it was formatted of for your Raspberry and boot. So it's a nice place for putting stuff like backup configurations and stuff that you don't access much, but you want with the machine.
That sounds pretty cool. I'm going to have to look into that.
I understand it will produce a remarkable increase in your boot performance if you just hand off the boot even to a USB stick, especially like a USB 3. Now, on a Raspberry Pi, it won't get USB 3 speeds, but the flash in a USB 3 is liable to be faster than whatever junk they throw into a USB 2.
And I never thought of this because I was thinking of going the other way. Will a Raspberry Pi Pixie boot? I was actually thinking one of the things I want to do with my Raspberry Pi is make it a Pixie boot server going the other way.
Well, not really, because you don't have, you'd have to have something somewhere that does the Pixie. You don't have that kind of capability in the current sort of BIOS level stuff. Not like you do on let's say I have AMD systems here. I have Asus where I can just pick out Pixie boot and it will go looking for a Pixie server. But I don't think you have quite enough brains. You barely have enough brains to boot off of a storage device.
There again, on the Pi 2, did they increase the hardware Ethernet and reconfigure that so it's not tied into the USB bus to where you get better performance?
No, Pi 2, I've studied this myself as pre-purchase stuff. The Pi 2 is still fast Ethernet, 100 megabit nominal. However, if you want to get faster net, not gig, but something faster than 100, USB 3 or USB 2 gigabyte external chips, external dongles, will get you faster than the onboard. Probably because there's a lot more processing power in the dongle than there is in the brain-dead little chip that they're using on the Pi.
Yeah, I remember that being one of the selling points of the C1, that it had a true Ethernet controller separate.
And if I remember correctly from one of the latest Linux for the Rest of Us store mentions, the Banana Pi does have gig Ethernet, so that might make a better Pixie server for you, or something with more than 100 megabit.
Well, that's true. I ought to put a banana pie router in the center of my whole network. It would solve a lot of problems.
By the way, I don't work for this company or anything, but Pluggable Technologies does a lot of good stuff for Linux systems, Mac OS X, and stuff like that. And a lot of their stuff has driver support in recent kernels. And they tend to be, I believe, a reasonable price. And they...
Hello?
Hello.
Netminer, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry if I took up too much time.
Well, it sounded like you dropped off in mid-sentence. Did you? I don't know if you finished your thought or that you were talking about.
I may have had a network glitch somewhere along the line, but I'm just saying that that if you look at pluggable stuff,
and another network glitch.
NSA got them.
No, it's Micro Center editing my broadcast for competition.
Okay. Guess we'll go on to the next topic. Weeb, did you want to tell us a little bit about your server fiasco you experienced here in the last few weeks?
Yeah. It's actually, it dovetails nicely off of your little raid talk there too, because it speaks to good cooling. Turns out, I thought earlier this week, or actually late last week, that my media server, which is running a raid and external setup, it kind of crapped the bed on me. And basically the short version is it overheated. So I was trying to boot it up this evening before the show to see how it was working out, and turns out it's working just fine now. So clean your fans, clean your dust out, and make sure the room that you have your servers in has more than one air vent in it. But so since I don't have to talk about fixing or troubleshooting the server, I can just give a little brief insight into the setup for it. It is a 1U case with a Atom processor in it. It is kind of a beefy Atom. It's a quad core Atom, 1.6 gigahertz per. It's got 2 gigs of RAM, and it is running an external RAID with an external SATA connector, with 4 drives in it set to RAID 10. RAID 10, in case for anyone who doesn't know, that's RAID 0 and RAID 1. So with the 4 drives, there's 4 2-terabyte drives. 2 of them are striped using RAID 0, and the other 2 are striped using RAID 0. And then those 2 stripes are mirrored using RAID 1, and that's basically what RAID 10 is. So I end up with a functional amount of 4 terabytes of drive space that I can actually use, with the added data paranoia benefit of if one of them goes down, I'm not really worried so much about parity as much as I can just re-image a mirror and be about my merry way. It doesn't get you as much space as RAID 5 would, but it's safer from a data availability and data paranoia standpoint.
Now, are you using software MDADM to configure that?
I am. The SATA card purports to have a built-in RAID controller, but a little bit of research shows that it's actually a fake RAID. So I basically just use that as a means of accessing the drives. The drives are individualized, and then I use software RAID to set them up. And like I said, it with this being pretty much all this machine does, with the exception of it also runs my house's local wiki, and that's pretty much it for that. And then for viewing the actual media, I've got a pair of Raspberry Pis on 2 different TVs, and they're running RaspBMC, though I guess I should look into OSMC at some point. I don't know if there's going to be a gentle migration from RaspBMC to OSMC, or if I'm going to have to reflash the thumb drive. But that's essentially the setup, and it's worked nicely for me for a couple of years now, and I'm slowly but surely still filling up that media server drive.
Do you have email notifications set up?
I do not. I really ought to. That actually all stems from my fear and dread of setting up email services on the actual machine. And I've done it in the past.
Search our archives, and there's an episode on a simple email alert notification system. The name of the app, it's in the most common of the repos, and it's called, where is it? Father Finch, I think he used the same one.
Yeah, I'm trying to recall it too, because that's the same one that I used when we were switching hosting services.
It's called SSMTP. SSM Mary, Sam, Mary, Tom, Paul. And it's available. I'll post the link that I used to set it up. And it's very simple. It doesn't require...
Sweet. Anything that gets me out of trying to do send mail or Qmail configs, that makes me happy.
I point it to my Gmail account, and it sends me notifications daily on stuff. It's very nice little application. Real simple to set up. One config file to put in all your email, the email address you want and server information you want it to go to.
Sweet. I'll have to check that out.
Thanks, guys. Between the RAD 10, which is great for the unreliable USB sticks, and the email notification stuff, you guys are setting me up big time. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. That's what we're here for. And then yep. in your MDADM config file, there's just one line you add to that to make it monitor and send emails from MADAM.
I had a general question.
Go ahead, Detmeyer. I was just checking to say that I just did a search on it. I'm running Arch Linux on that machine, I should also mention. And the SSMTP package is in the extra repo, so I'll be installing that very soon.
Well, I was wondering, if you were going to set up machines now, would you wait for Debbie and Jesse to come out and percolate through, or would you start with Wheezy?
Depends on the hardware, I guess. I've tried rolling through a Debian release, going from Jesse to Wheezy. I've had success once, I believe, and failure another time, but that was because I was using some applications that were not in the repos. So using, like a web server based application like Moodle or something, and that we just, instead of using the Moodle package in the repositories, we downloaded the zip file, and unzipped it to the correct place and configured it from there. And then when you rolled from Squeeze to Wheezy, I think it was, it borked up that install, and I think it would have been better if we would have just stuck with the version in the package manager.
Yeah, as much as I like Debian, I think I would say go with Ubuntu or Mint or Elementary or LXLE or something like that, because my license. I installed Debian because I had limited memory resources on this laptop when I got it, but unfortunately, there's just been so many things I've run in from the graphics accelerator to the fingerprint reader that just are not on Debian at all.
That said, if you're just setting up a file server, this is not something that you're going to be doing. Chances are good it's not dealing with a lot of really new hardware. You're not dealing with a lot of crazy configurations, or you're probably not even going to want to do a lot of updates very regularly on it. So Debian may be, the good old, very rarely updated Debian may be a safer choice for it in the long run. I mean, like I said, I'm running Arc on mine because I'm comfortable with Arc and that's what I like to use. But if you're doing a standard file server, Debian might be the way to go. And I mean, if you're using the older the not yet released version of it, they do keep some stability on that for and backport bug fixes and stuff for quite a while.
And this is probably another place where Slack would be a fully legitimate choice. Now, Fweeb, are you saying Arc or Arch?
I'm saying Arc because I was working with somebody who constantly called it Arc and it rubbed off. But I know it because it's built on the architecture, which is why he was pronouncing it that way. But Arch feels fun better, but Arc also requires me to move my mouth less.
I think like laziness to make decisions.
Absolutely. I just wanted to make sure there was not a distro out there I was completely aware of. I was going to ask you what Arc was.
Well, the big thing about Debian's changeover this spring is going to be systemd integration. And that may mean that I may try it on a testing VM and then let everybody else grind it through as the new versions of Raspbian or whatever come out.
Ubuntu Server Edition is quite nice too. I run that. Well, I run that on some VMs and also on hardware also. But it's a nice little server distro. And if you stick with the long term support package version, which I think is now 14.04.2, I think is what they've got the latest ISO you'll find on their website. I've had better success rolling from LTS to LTS versions with Ubuntu. It's worked out real well.
I'm actually running a 14.04 Linux Lite installation and on an old P4 single core system. By the way, anybody guess whether a Raspberry Pi or this P4 are faster or more performant?
I'd say the Raspberry Pi is going to take less juice, but it depends. If you're talking about the original Pi, there's a lot of Pentium 4s out there a lot faster than 800 megahertz. So you got to give us more information.
Well, no, my P4 is original 2.66 single core early generation. I think it may be even a 475 plug socket. And I'm going to be replacing that with a Pi. I was just wondering what I was going to get for performance. I know I'll get better screen activity because I'll be able to use modern screens. This is using the old Intel chip, which doesn't handle widescreen very well.
You're saying you're replacing with a Pi, so I assume you're replacing it with a version 2 Pi.
Yes, I'm going to go with all version 2. I don't have a Pi 1, and it doesn't seem like the difference in price makes a Pi 1 worth anything except for a very dedicated application and a very price sensitive one.
Yeah, I think you probably eventually will be able to pick up Pi 1s on the secondary market pretty cheap. But from my personal experience with the Pi 2, definitely this thing is faster on most stuff than a P4. Now, I don't think I'd want to play, even from the P4 era, game. Well, I don't even think there's main for the Pi, but if they're, or not main, but Wine. But even if there was, I don't think I'd want to try to port a game, run a game in an emulator or a virtual environment on the Pi, other than the old arcade games, the MAME stuff. So it depends on what you want to do. And like I said, I have found out there isn't any, officially there's no flash for the ARM controller other than an Android. And I'm still, I've investigated various avenues, but I haven't gone down that road yet. So I can pretty much play any YouTube video that I've ever tried. But some of the things like going to the CW and playing TV shows that I missed or something doesn't work.
You don't need to use one on the Raspberry Pi 2. You can totally put Windows 10 on there. That's going to happen.
Yeah, but from what I heard, and I haven't seen it since they first announced it, that the Windows 10 was only going to be a command line version of Windows.
Is there such a thing?
Oh, yeah. They've got a server edition that's only command line, you know, a terminal-based.
Well, they just call it DOS.
Yeah. Well, who cares?
Well, for anything sophisticated, I've got two APU Generation 1 desktops, but I'm planning on getting rid of my old XP class machines, and I was wondering how much a Pi is going to beat the... You're saying a Pi is going to beat the old XP class machines, except for perhaps memory capacity, just because my P4's got 2 gig and the Pi's got 1.
Well, if that's even a consideration, look at hard kernels C1. It's 2 gig of RAM and $35, same as the Pi, quad core CPU and quad core video controller.
I think if I were going to go to anything but Pis, it's largely a learning machine. It's replacing my hacking Linux box with another hacking machine. But if I was going to go to anything, I would probably go to a QB Pro of some generation. The little ARM square, and it has SATA and it has a whole bunch of other stuff that would make a nice little machine if I was really serious about blowing this out. I'm just planning on doing very low buck experimentation.
Well, I plan to get the C1. I've had an Odroid before, but there is a difference. I mean, Odroid on has much better performance. You know, for every Odroid hacker out there who and telling you how to do cool things, there's 100 people out there telling you how to do cool things with the Pi.
That's my experience. I can get the Pi locally, and the Odroid is an order thing, so I may gradually build up my Pi universe from local supplies. Again, I'm talking about a very low budget environment, so I've looked at some of the others, and I'm just going to be recycling like the hard drives and stuff from my old desktops for Pis and for server use. Pi server, probably. I also have a couple of USB drives here that are pretty good size, so putting them off on a server would be nice.
Yeah, my first experience with the Odroid that I had, I think it took, they told me expect 6 weeks, and I think it took 4 to get it. My first, I had a Pi 1, which I never even plugged into anything, a Model B, and I think I had that thing within 3 days because it was on a regular retail site. I think it may have been a week and a half on my Model B Plus, which of course I got after the fire, and it, you know, the Pi 2 was longer than that. I think it was about a month between ordering it and when it showed up.
Well, I think I can go to my local Micro Center and pick them up off the shelf mostly.
Well, that's the value in living in a more urban environment. You know, where I am, online is pretty much my only option for anything exotic.
Yeah, I understand. Really, both my folks were from small country towns. I miss the country, but I don't drive, so I'm very glad that I'm on the fringe of the city.
So just as a side note, if you're going to be using your Pi as more of a server thing, I suggest using a distro called Minibian, which takes away a lot of the X and stuff like that involved with Raspbian. And out of curiosity, what is your concerns with switching over from the init to systemd?
My concerns are just the kind of problems that Arch people have had when they switched over. I'm just saying that I could putter around. Since I haven't bought anything or set anything up, I may just wait a month or two until the first debugs and revs come out from the universe. And I know that Raspbian isn't really up to Jesse anyway, although there are ways of installing it.
Yeah, not that I'm any expert, but it seems to me that the systemd transition for, say, Fedora and Arch, I would expect that to go a lot more smoothly than it would be for Debian.
Now, what were the problems that people had with the transition from initd to systemd?
I think a lot of it is people invested years in. It's not so for me. I wouldn't say I'm not a power user, but you know, I'm not who, you know, delved into the meat of System 5 like some people have, and for the people, system administrators, stuff like that, who have spent their lives building up, you know, toolkits to deal with System 5, and then all of a sudden they're confronted with something else that they have to, you know, a new learning curve. I think that's the main thing. Not that the distros came out and suddenly they didn't work, but that's, you know, people had to go out and suddenly learn a new paradigm.
For me, the migration to systemd was mostly it was a hassle, mostly because I was a little slack in keeping up with my updates for a while there, and so by the time the systemd update went through, it had been a number of months before I had actually done an update to my system, and so all of the transitionary stuff that would have happened if I was doing it in time, those tools and stuff weren't really as readily available, or the distro, the rolling distro part of it had kind of moved beyond me. So I ended up, was one of the rare times where I ended up nuking the OS part of my workstation and simply reinstalling, and from there it was fine. The other reason is that when you're dealing with a rolling release, at least like Arch, you have a lot of configuration files, and what happens is you'll end up with a lot of orphaned configuration files that were using the old init setup as opposed to the systemd setup, and trying to clean that up can be a bit of a hassle. I mean, it's not a big deal. It's just sort of an annoyance when it comes to that. So that's where the hassle was for me. It really wasn't all that big of a deal. And you know, once on the other side of the transition, it's not so horrible. If you're going on a more release based distro like Debian or Ubuntu or whatever, then I mean, usually the recommendation there anyway is don't even worry about a clean upgrade path. Just wipe it and install anyway. So,
but nothing broke, right?
No, well, I also didn't give it the opportunity to break, just because there's, again, I wasn't interested in having a lot of orphan configs, so I went ahead and nuked the OS portion and reinstalled. It wasn't that difficult for me to do.
But nobody has anybody heard of any breakage from the upgrade, or is it just basically just a new system and that new system that people had to learn, and what was the other complaint I've heard before, that the log files were in a binary mode and that you needed to set it up a certain way to be able to read the log files, something along those lines?
Yeah, it's harder to say do a tail on your system log because it's not a straight up text file anymore. That's a truism.
A lot of it seemed to be a lack of reading the friendly manual.
But that would be for people who would actually use something that or went down that deep into their system.
Or if you're just running a service. I mean, sometimes it's if you're used to checking whether or not a daemon is running, and you're used to doing it one way, and you're regularly typing that command, and you have to stop yourself and remember how to type the new sequence. And I mean, again, it's an annoyance based on a workflow that you've ingrained into yourself.
I think my point being, by and large, if you were using something like setting up your Raspberry Pi as a file sharing server, and it switched over from Wheezy to Jesse, I don't think you're going to experience any sort of breaking or anything like that. It's just going to be a big switch, and then now you're going to have to learn how to use systemd over init.
Since I don't know init anyway, I may just putter on my little VMs and then let everybody else be the first wave through in the universe on and upgrade after everybody else has sort of found the corner cases. Just because I'm going to be basically puttering, I can putter with Wheezy for the little stuff that I want to do, just learning how to set up the basics of a server. And then when everybody upgrades for Raspbian, Minbian, or whatever I'd use, actually if I can afford it, I may go with a Raspbian machine and a Minbian machine, one of them being attached to my big TV and the other one just being attached to disk. By just waiting a little while, all of the transition stuff will naturally work itself out, especially since this is a secondary transition after Fedora and Arch and everybody have broken trail. Well, thanks, guys.
Well, is everybody about ready for the after party?
If by after party you mean going to bed, yes.
Okay, well, we've been Linux Slugcast number 29, and I've been your host, 5150, and I've been joined by Father Finch.
Have a great week, everyone.
And everybody's first mate, Fweeb.
See ya!
And Honky Magoo.
Have a good night.
Kevin Wisher.
Good evening, and thanks for listening and downloading.
And if I'm not mistaken, first time attendee Netminer.
I was briefly on last week, but have a good fortnight, everybody. That's the next couple of weeks till we meet again.
Okay, sorry about that. And we had Taj.
Peace, people. See you later.
And briefly, we had some folks in the listening booth. I wish them a good night. The next recording date will be the 1st of May, 2015. Our intro and outro music is Downright, provided by Claw2 in Rome. We want to give special thanks to Tony Bemis from the Sunday Morning Linux Review for our web hosting. And I want to give thanks to Tony because he offered to let me stay on his couch for PangoCon later this month, which I believe I'm going to take him up on. WordPort and script to keep our IRC bot connected. Also, thanks to Bemis. I want to thank Elwin, as always, for providing our Mumble server and creating the bot module we use to find the next show recording date. You just have to go in Freenode, go to the hash Linux Slugcast channel and type .ns on the IRC command line, and that will always tell you when the next recording date is. So I've been 5150, and we'll catch you all on the flip side, folks.
The Sunday Morning Linux Review is a weekly podcast with three hosts, Tony Bemis, Matt Enders, and Mary Tomich. They talk about Linux and open source subjects ranging from kernel updates, newly released Linux distros, Linux reviews, and tech news of the week. There are also special segments including Mary's Quiz Show, Is It Alive? They broadcast live on Google On Air, Audio Stream, and chat on IRC. For details, please visit the website www.smlr.us.